back on the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, RickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So this weekend, a fantastic event going on in Baltimore. All day event to celebrate the 140th anniversary of the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. And, you know, it's one of those moments in history, and I remember, learning about it. And I remember when we did our labor history tour back in 2013, the first stop we made was in Martinsburg, West Virginia, where it had arguably one of the places where the strike had begun. We were told there was a marker there. And we searched the roundhouse, which is a beautiful train roundhouse, a beautiful place. But we were told there was a marker there. And we looked all over the place. And finally we found it, where we had to go through the roundhouse, jump down on the railroad tracks, walk about a quarter mile down the tracks, and then look up about 15 feet to where it was on the other side of the marker that talked about the roundhouse. And it should have been the message that labor's history has been, well, if not hidden, destroyed, rewritten, and, well, co-opted, which is why I find these events so very important, which is why we've asked Bill Berry to come talk with us. Bill is a retired director of labor studies at the Community College of Baltimore County. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, but thank you for what you do.
I look at this, and again, I go back to that moment when we did our labor history tour, and that moment where you go, wait a second, this is supposedly a great place in our history. Why'd they hide it?
Well, it's a historical distortion. And one of the things we're doing for the workshop, for the program on Saturday, is combining panels on the history of the strike with officers from railroad unions today. Because history is useful. And we look at how workers built movements in the past, we can learn. It's like best practices. And the people who control the cities and the political leaders don't want us to learn those lessons. And we have an example here in Baltimore where the mansion called Evergreen House of John Ward Garrett, who was the owner or the president of the B&O, gold-plated bathrooms, the books of 3,000, it's preserved, and people get tours. And there was nothing for the railroad workers until recently, when a group of independent people renovated an old row house and made it into the Irish Railroad Workers Shrine. And so when I asked the state to create a historical marker, and there is one other historical marker in Maryland, which was to commemorate the house where Mother Jones lived before she died.
Yep, I've been there.
We wanted it at Camden Yards, which was now our famous baseball stadium, but was main terminal for the B&O Railroad, and it was great. It's right at the public area by the station. Now, probably 2 million people a year walk right by it. How many of them look at it, I can't tell you, but it's a great location.
Yeah, I mean, and it's one of those things. It's one of those things, Bill, that we as working people have to demand, not just, at places like Camden Yards, but in our schools. I mean, you talk about this stuff, and, people who are of, a little younger than me, they've never heard of it.
I know. Well, I mean, it's something in every local, and I do local union training now, and I emphasize to them that every local website should have a local labor history, because new hires come to the job. And they think, oh, I got everything that I got because I'm so smart, or God gave it to me.
Or the benevolent corporation gave it to us.
Yeah, and if the benevolent boss gave it. And they don't understand what the older members went through to get it, often a strike, complicated negotiations. And it's the beginning of an education that should start day one with a new member on the job, and particularly in shops where you have an open shop. Because where membership is voluntary, the new people have to appreciate what they have with the union.
And the struggles, the people who fought, bled, and died, not just for the 8-hour day, but for weekends, for vacations, for safe working conditions. You can go down the list.
But it's also localized. I'm working at a place and you have a daily overtime, for example. The law doesn't require that, but the union got it. And so every time I get overtime for working 9 hours a day, I'm getting a benefit of that.
Right.
And I'm standing, there's a very nice website and presentation by the IBEW local in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And the president, Paul Cameron, says, "We're standing in the shade of trees that the older members planted." And it's a great way of putting it and talking about what we owe them and why we want to commemorate. But that's why the people who control the school systems don't want this information taught in history courses.
Yeah, well, let me ask you.
They don't want it made public.
Let's get to the weekend event. The Great Railroad Strike of 1877. Yep. What is it people should know? Why is this still relevant? Why is it important 140 years later? What do people need to know?
What happened is the first Great Railroad Strike happened, and one of the elements of it is Baltimore chauvinism. That is, almost all the history books claim that the strike started in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Martinsburg was very, very important during the strike, but it actually started at 9:30 in the morning on July 16th, right at Camden Yards, when a group of locomotive firemen, said, "We're not going to take a second 10% wage cut." And I had a great experience here in Baltimore of meeting the granddaughter of one of the original strikers from Martinsburg, West Virginia. She's now living here. She's 92 years old. With all due respect, she's sharper than you or me. But her memories of her father and grandfather are very strong. And so we're going to have a three-part program. One of them is going to meet at the marker, kind of introduce people to it. We had a big unveiling ceremony a couple years ago when it was posted. And I was surprised, but not disappointed, how few people knew about the strike. So, as you know, we've got a book on the strike. We're then going to go over to the B&O Railroad Museum, which has created an exhibit on the strike. And they have for years done histories of the company and totally leave out this momentous event. And the strike in 1877 went nationwide. Hundreds of thousands of people, general strikes in East St. Louis, roundhouse burned in Pittsburgh, 10 innocent bystanders shot to death here in Baltimore City. And it was an incredible moment in American history. So we're going to have a history of the strike, and then we're going to have a panel with officers, as I said, from unions, talking about the problems they're having on railroads today. And they are apparently considerable. I'm looking forward to hearing some of that material.
Again, it's one of those things, history repeats itself, because, I talk to some people that I know who work on railroads and who represent railroad workers, and it sounds a lot like the yep. battles of the yep. past that you yep. just keep fighting over and over again.
Yep.
And this is what I keep saying. I go, the reason we need to learn this history is our children are going to have to fight. My kids are going to have to fight these battles
yep.
over again.
Yep. And I think that's very, very important. I think as parents, it's great to talk about history and working class and movement. But as parents, we want our kids to be able to do better than we did. And our parents and grandparents wanted that. And in generally, it was true. But boy, not today.
So now going back to the strike, because, you said that they refused to take a second 10% wage cut.
Yeah.
Were wages the only issue? I mean, put me back in that time.
It was pretty much the only issue. And it was a little bit like what Naomi Klein calls the shock doctrine, and that is where companies will take advantage of an economic situation to do what they've always wanted to do. And there was a recession in 1873-74, and so at the end of 1876, the B&O cut everybody's wages 10%. And they also said they would fire any worker who lost his house, and those workers were going through pay cuts, and if they had houses, they were in trouble. They even did something which was incredible. They used to, if you were on a crew, and the crew involved brakemen, engineers, and firemen, and conductors, and you were sent, for example, on a run to Western Maryland, you were then allowed to deadhead back, that is, hop the next train and come home, because your shift was over. The B&O was so cheap that they said, okay, we're going to do away with that. So you can wait for your next assignment home, or you can pay your way as a passenger, or you can just stay over in places like Martinsburg and and dime stuff to cut pay. And the B&O and all of this time during the strike and during the recession never cut dividend payments to the stockholders.
Of course not.
Still at 10%. So
of course not. You never cut dividend payments to the investors, and you never cut the CEO and the executives' pay. Never.
That's right. So some, in that sense, history repeats itself. So.
Now, how many people are we talking about were on strike during this time?
Well, it's hard to know. I would say 100,000. But wow. One of the things which was very important, and this is nationwide, and it was small railroads and big railroads and little mom-and-pop operations, because the railroad industry was just kind of getting established as a nationwide, it was the first nationwide corporation structure, even established time zones, because the railroads needed to know what time it was in California, and you can't go by the sun. But communities stepped up, and this is something which I think unions fail to do today, is establish connection with people in the community. And it was so strong, as I was talking to somebody last night, that the main way in which the government tried to control the strikers initially was through militia. But the militia were like National Guard people today. They're the second job. And so many of the militia in many cities, including Baltimore, were sympathetic to the strikers. They were related to them. And in a couple of towns, the militia came in, turned their weapons over to the strikers, and went home. So the federal government then, the President of the United States, who'd run for President Hayes, on the campaign that he would withdraw federal troops from all states, and he was talking about the South, sent in troops here from Fort McHenry to break the strike. They had machine guns, and Gatling guns. So it was a major effort. And you'll see pictures of huge numbers of people, community people, involved in the strike. There's a famous story in Martinsburg with these two brothers, the Zepps, that one of them was the leader of the strike, Richard, and the other, George, was a major scab. But George was going to run an engine as an engineer, and his wife and daughter got on the train crying, pleading with him not to run it because it was so much opposed by the neighborhood, and he got down from the train.
It's that kind of, again, you know, I've said the exact same thing, where the Union Hall used to be the center of the community, and we need to go back to those days. But you look at the government's response, and I don't think it would be all that different today.
No, it's certainly not today. And the danger is that you have professionalized response, that is, police, it's military. One of the things that strategies that was discovered during the strike in 1877 was one that's used today, and that is to send National Guard to areas where they don't live. And the crisis in Baltimore on the 20th, which was the Friday night of the strike, started because the governor of Maryland was going to send National Guard troops from Baltimore out to the western part of the state where they didn't know anybody. And the two militia companies were ordered to march from their armories to Camden Yard Station, where special trains were set up to take them out to Western Maryland. And one of them marched down a major street in Baltimore, and they had to link arms, and the crowds tried to stop them, blocked the streets, children, women. That company got through. Another company tried to leave an armory on the far side of our harbor and march across to the station, and the people just getting out of work blocked the street. They were throwing bricks at paving work. This militia started shooting, and as I said, they killed 10 innocent people, none of whom was a striker, none of whom was related to a striker. A 10-year-old newsboy supporting his widowed mother was killed. Horrible story. They finally made it to the terminal, but within a day, all but three of these militia people had deserted. They had people bring them civilian clothes into the terminal. What we see then is Pennsylvania, for example, where you are. A famous event happened on the Sunday night of the strike, the 22nd, when strikers burned the roundhouse in Pittsburgh. And the people in that that roundhouse were militia from Philadelphia, and they were specifically sent out there by Tom Scott, the governor of Pennsylvania, because they were strangers to the area. And it was a lot of Civil War veterans were working for the Army that time. Many of them were working for the P&O. And so reports on the strike often sound like we're having another Gettysburg. And they're talking about positioning and being on a hillside and lining up the artillery and stuff like that. So, one of the great documents of the strike that I found was a personal letter from the head of the Gatling Machine Gun Company to John Garrett on company stationery saying, we sorry we couldn't supply you during a strike with more of our guns, but we're back and we were overloaded with demand. But a few of these and a couple of loyal people, you will clear the track.
Wow.
And they're clearly advocating shooting to kill.
Just mow them all down. And, yeah. And sadly, I don't see that sentiment being any different than you would get today. Let me ask you last line of questioning, because, I mean, this is a fascinating topic and I think important history to remember. Where should people go to get more information? Is there a website? Is there somewhere that you would suggest a book?
Well, they can look at the B&O Railroad Museum. And we're talking about setting up a website now with all the interest in the strike. And I think I sent you the documentary that the young men did in Ada, Michigan. Did I send that to you?
No, you didn't, but I'll make sure I get it so we can get it up on our website.
Well, this was a great event, History Day, and this is something else I encourage the people in Pennsylvania and encourage people in every state to do. In Maryland, History Day is where students at high school and middle school get together and they compete by creating projects on a theme. And the theme this year was Take a Stand. But about 5 years ago, we shook down everybody here in Maryland and created a History Day prize in labor history to try and get students to do projects on this. And we've had great winners every year. This year, two young men in Ada, Michigan, which is the hometown of Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Labor, did a great documentary video on the strike. And I'll send it to you. I thought I had. But terrific pictures of the strike and narration and a great description.
Good stuff. We'll have to take a look at it. And we'll get it up on the website at thericksmithshow.com.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought I had sent that to you.
So we'll make sure folks have a chance at it. Bill, I appreciate the time. Best of luck on Saturday and keep up the good work.
Well, we appreciate everything that you do. I wish we had a program like yours down here.
Anytime you want to come back, let me know. Thanks so much, Bill.
All right, Rick. Thank
Great
you.
Talking with you.
Bye.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
The first ones to die. The first ones in line for that pie in the sky.